Welcome to another episode of Out of the Blank Podcast. Bruce, it is a pleasure to have you on the show. Would you mind introducing yourself to everyone out there listening?
Yeah, sure, Rob. Thank you for inviting me. My name is Bruce Solheim. I'm a professor of history at Citrus College in Glendora, California. And I'm 65 years old now, approaching the end of my career. And I've done a lot of things. I've worked in as a defense contractor. I was in the U.S. Army as an aviator. And I've been in academics for about 32 years teaching college history. And it was only in 2016 that I decided I was going to start telling the untold part of my story, which is the paranormal part that I had been experiencing since I was 4 or 5 years old. And I was afraid before that because I held secret and top secret clearances in the military and also in the defense industry and also in academics. It's not like something you want to bring forward when you're trying to get tenure as a professor. So I share a lot of the concerns that a lot of professional people, scientists, academics have, that you have to be very careful what you tell people. You could lose your job, lose your funding, lose your security clearances, you know, things like that. But at this point, at 65 or 60, you know, I guess when I, or earlier, but at the end of my career, I'm not worried about that anymore. It's more important to get the truth out there and let people decide for themselves. So that's kind of where I'm at.
I'm going to have you on probably plenty of times to be able to cover all the various things that you do cover. But I want to ask about what your belief is of the paranormal, like what's your idea of it? Because everyone has their own, I guess, picture of what it is. And I want to ask more about the stigma as well, too, because I notice, and I think I've mentioned to you this off air, which is that if you ask people about a paranormal experience, they won't necessarily say, I don't know if it's paranormal, but they'll start explaining something that they really can't explain. And it starts to be like, we should start having the conversations around it to get rid of that stigma, just so you might come across a really good story or someone's really good experience, and you could be missing out because people are afraid to do so, especially in academia. They just don't want to acknowledge anything, except if it's based in a textbook that's written by McGraw-Hill.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the corporate textbook. Yeah, exactly. Written by a team of academics who are too afraid to color outside of the lines.
Exactly.
You know? Yeah.
So what's your idea of the paranormal?
Well, you know, I a lot of other people say this too, but I generally agree with it. The paranormal is really normal and the supernatural is really natural. I mean, it's who we were as ancient people. If you know, go back in ancient times, and even if you talk to indigenous people, let's say Native Americans or the Aborigines in Australia, I mean, this is a part of their everyday life that they accept as real. It's not strange or spooky or anything else. It's what the Aborigines call dream time, or, you know, whether it's communicating with the star people, according to Native Americans, or just accepting the ability to have telepathy and psychokinesis and all that. It's all very much accepted in Eastern, you know, societies too, in India and so forth. It's, you know, it's more generally accepted than our modern Western technological society that has kind of abandoned the ancient truths or the ancient knowledge. But I think we're coming around to a time now where people are starting to realize, oh, I guess we need to consider that. But it's difficult. It's difficult to do that. So my concept is that it's as my friend Gene said, who passed away in 2016, came to me in a vision a month after he passed away, around October 2016. He said, listen, Bruce, it's all true. Because I was asking, well, is this true? Is that true? Did this really happen to me? You know, because I, even though I've had all these experiences, I you know, there's still that a little bit of doubt, you know, there's still a little bit of skepticism, because that's natural. It's healthy for a person not to just believe everything you're told, you know, try to filter it, try to understand it. And he said, listen, it's all true. And that was the beginning. That was the beginning of my ability to start publishing the books of all my stories in the Timeless series. And so anyway, that's my impression of the paranormal, is that it is normal.
You mentioned visions, like extra sensory abilities. Like I used to get deja vu all the time, and it really was, a lot of people always told me it was supposed to stop after childhood. Like young kids get it all the time, but mine never stopped. Sometimes it's mostly like if I'm what I would call a dream, would be something that later I'll have like the exact same thing happen. And I have to think about how many times am I on a routine? Do I just do the same thing over and over again? I really try and find a rational explanation for it, but there's some things where I'm like, no, that's dead on. And it was supposed to be a dream and it actually came true. Like there was n nothing in my normal life that would have created that.
Right. Yeah. No, I mean, materialists, people who don't adhere to the paranormal or supernatural or any of that would tell you that, well, it's just a glitch in your brain, that, it didn't really, you didn't, it's just the way you're remembering and it's not really in that sequence or whatever. But my idea, not just mine, but others as well, is that what you're doing is peering beyond the interface. What the interface is, what it's kind of like your computer keyboard. You're pushing keys or maybe voice input or whatever, but the actual what's actually going on is a toggling on and off of circuits, right? That's beyond the interface, but we don't recognize that. We don't, unless you're digging into a computer or whatever, or programming it. So what David Bohm, the American physicist, called the explicate order is the interface. That's our everyday, what we're doing right now. The implicate order is beyond that. It is the spirit world. It is the quantum world. It is the way things really are. But we have an interface to try to help us understand it, because otherwise it's too much for most people. It's like, wait a second, are you saying that there's spirits around me all the time? Dead people or I see dead people, I mean, they're all around me all the time and other entities and so forth. Well, yeah, but that's too much for most people to handle. So they have an interface that makes it easier to go through life. And it's also true with time, the idea of time. That's the other thing Gene told me when I had that vision, was that and a vision is a concept of peering into the implicate order, the quantum world. And right. So he said that there is no future, there's no past where I am. It's all happening at the same time. It's all like, which is what the quantum world is like. If you talk to quantum physicists at that subatomic level, that's the way it is, and that is the reality. But what we see now is the explicate order or the interface.
Kind of like the different theories of time, like AB world hypothesis, to talk about that the past exists at the same time the present exists, but the future is yet to exist. And then there's another theory that all three timelines exist at the same time. Like the right now, the war of 18, 17, what it's existing all happening at once, but we're perceiving only this timeline or this reality that we're in. And it begs the question, if that's true, is that an evolutionary thing? Like we just eventually just lost that ability. Like there's plenty of things that we've lost the ability. Not, most kids do not know who even John Lennon is or don't know how to write a letter. So if you really look at how quickly that happened over time, we talk about a couple hundreds of years. Could we just lose the ability to be in touch with what we were calling belief? Could have been another extrasensory factor.
Well, it's something you're born with, the idea of this connection. Because if you talk to children, there's been research done on past lives, that children, when they're very young, they sometimes can remember lives that, they had led, that there's no way they could have known, what it was like to be a fighter pilot in World War II, for the British or whatever. But somehow this little kid is talking as if he lived through that experience, But then usually as they get older, they forget all of that, because what happens is society says that's not real. It happened to me. As a young kid, I was had invisible playmates, which a lot of, or invisible to other people. They were very real to me. And a lot of things were very real to me. But as soon as I started going to school, you're regimented, you're a good little soldier, you're sitting in nice, neat rows, of desks. And I remember telling my kindergarten teacher, yeah, Johnny told me this the other day. And she said, who's Johnny? And I said, that's my playmate, my invisible playmate. Nobody else can see him. And she said, no, we don't talk about things like that. That's just your imagination. It's not real. So I remember going home to my mom and telling her, you know, she said, it's not, Johnny's not real. And my mom, who was very psychic, by the way, and taught me telepathy and everything, she said, there's certain places where you can talk about it and there's certain places where you can't. So you just got to kind of keep it to yourself sometimes. So she didn't tell me not to talk about it. She just said, consider, you know, what we said in the military, situational awareness. You know, don't stick your neck out if you don't have to about this stuff. So what it does is it kind of gets beaten out of us, and we're taught, you know, and this goes back to the scientific revolution, you know, this idea of materialism that, you know, and Newtonian physics and so forth, you know, that we have to, it's, you know, there is nothing like that. That's all superstition. That's, you know, ancient superstition. But now we're realizing that, oh, wait a second, we shouldn't have abandoned that. There's no reason we have to abandon modern science or our technological progress, but we should also embrace what the ancients knew and that we've forgotten. So I think it's kind of emerging, what I call the era of reconversion, you know, where we reconvert to what we knew before and match it up and combine it with our scientific progress. So you don't have to abandon one to accept the other.
Did you ever ask your mom about her experience of how she became so self-aware that you can't talk about this in certain places? There's certain places you can, but there's certain places that you can't.
I think it mimicked her experience of being an immigrant. You know, my parents came to the United States in 1948 after World War II. They lived under Nazi occupation in Norway. My dad was even in a labor camp during that time, but they came here to start a new life. And my mom quickly learned that, I remember she told me this, she was on a bus in Seattle traveling with her elderly aunt who had come to America in a much earlier time. And she was talking Norwegian to her, and her aunt said, don't speak Norwegian. If you can't speak English yet, just don't say anything. So just keep it to yourself. And my mom thought it was weird, but what it was is that she didn't want it to be identified as being a foreigner. You know, that was the idea. So this idea that your identity, who you are, you have to kind of hide it. And I think that's what we teach children, unfortunately, you know, because children are great scientists and philosophers and also are able to see things that adults have been taught not to see. And we kind of just push it out of them. And I think it's changing. It's changing. And a lot of things are happening right about now. Actually, since the time that Gene came to me in that vision, a lot of things have happened that have changed the paradigm. But there's a lot of resistance to it, too. And, you know, my definition of history, because I teach history, it all comes back to this, that history is all about forces for change and forces against change over time. There's that constant dynamic going on. And so that, you know, that is, I think, what is happening.
Do you believe people would change if they were shown clear evidence of it? Like, I look at those X-Files shows and those things like that. I think they really did a giant disservice to the actual discussion, whether it was for views. And I understand it's Hollywood. You got to make money somehow. But there are real, like, YouTubers that don't make any money. And they really just try and go. My buddy's one of them that goes on ghost hunts or to haunted locations, and he really is just like, I'm not going to lie to you, I'm not going to hype it up, I just want to see if we can see anything. So they bring all their little electronics and all these things to be able to try and pick up something, and watching it, I get goosebumps, because there is some things where I'm like, that's really strange, and I don't know how you can really explain that. And he's like, I can't explain it either, but I'm just showing you what we got.
Yeah, and well, you bring up a good point, and that's that people expect, because of Hollywood and movies that they've seen and so forth, they expect Harry Potter magic, you know, in the paranormal. And really what it is much more subtle. Occasionally there's something pretty dramatic, but it's rare. So if you're going to do a show, you can't do this occasionally rare dramatic thing that happens about once every 10 years or 5 years, whatever you would capture it. You don't have the resources to do that, you'll lose your audience. So what do? You got to hype it up, you know. And I've talked to Hollywood people. I talk to them quite often, and that's one thing they always say. Yeah, we'd like to interview you, but you know, keep in mind we're a Hollywood thing. And I go, yeah, I get it. I get what you're doing. You know, I've written plays. I know how to dramatize things. You know, stuff like that. I'm a writer. So, but that's why they have to do. But like, for instance, my friend Dean Radin, who's the chief scientist at IONS, which is the Institute of Noetic Sciences, and that's the one that was started by astronaut Edgar Mitchell, who had a very profound experience in space where he knew we weren't alone. He knew. And he came back to Earth and he started this Institute of Noetic Sciences. Anyway, Dean Radin, Dr. Dean Radin, is a scientist there, and he does experiments in telepathy and psychokinesis and all the other paranormal things. And they have evidence. There's like 100 years worth of evidence, but a lot of it is very subtle. So if you tell somebody or show them the evidence, like you said, and they say, well, this person with their mind controlled an object and moved it so many millimeters, right? The person is going to go, wait, it's not like, you know, it's not like being thrown across the room at 100 miles an hour. You know, it's not very, it's like it moves a tiny little bit. And what gets lost on them is the idea that they moved it with their mind. You know, it might have only moved a few millimeters, but they moved it with their mind. Do you get it? That's what it is. And people go, you know, they're kind of like jaded because, hey, it's not what I see on the screen. You know, it has to be more dramatic for me to believe it. When you really think about it, you know, and what I do, like in my paranormal class, I used to teach a paranormal history class at Citrus where I teach. And one of the first things I do in the class is I do a "Are you being stared at?" experiment. And we pair off and you have somebody turn their back to you, and then you either stare at them or you don't stare at them for a certain prescribed length of time. And then at a certain point, the person says, "I think you're staring at me," or "I think you're not." And then they do another iteration, right? And they do this a number of times. And what we found is that way above chance, people know when people are staring at them. So, I mean, you know, that is an experiment, although it's a very small experiment and, you know, limited control group. It plays through every time. And how can that be explained? We don't have eyes in the back of our head. So what's going on? Well, there's this certain sense that we have that I think everybody has experienced, probably everybody, like you started the show with, you know, that everybody's had something. That's probably one thing they've had, but they often write it off to, oh, it's just instinct, or it's my gut telling me that somebody's staring at me. I felt something burning in the back of my, I turned around, but they don't necessarily consider it paranormal. Whereas it is paranormal. It is. And it goes back to our ancient roots when that was absolutely necessary to survive. I mean, I think it is now too, but, you know, especially if you're in a dangerous field, like I was in the army. I worked in a prison. You have to have eyes in the back of your head to survive. You don't know what's going on behind. You can't trust things going on behind you and just assume they're not going to kill you. So, you know, police officers, firefighters, you know, whatever it is, any of those really dangerous jobs, you have to have harken back to that instinct. So it is very real. That's the thing. It's just not, it's subtle. And that's what's hard for people to believe. They want, you know, whether it's a UFO landing on the lawn of the White House or something, you know, like that, it's probably not going to be that. You have to think differently, think outside of this materialist box that we've been taught.
If you explained it like how you just did to me and to everyone out there listening about like the similar feeling of eyes peering into you without you really being able to see them right in front of you, it could be from behind you. Do you find that if you can explain that to someone, they start to agree and start to get on the same level as you? But like, what's the hesitation amongst academics or other types of people that have like ivory tower syndrome, where they just can't get off their pedestal of being, this is science and this is how this fact, and we know this because of this. I mean, this is something that we really never super research into. Specific people have, of course, but the large societal acceptance of this has not been pushed towards that area of researching into this. It's more been about either clicks or it's been about ignoring it completely. So trying to get people to understand the discussion so you can show them, hey, this isn't as crazy as it sounds.
Right. And it's peer pressure. It's also financial. As a researcher, if you're going out for grants, if you're a scientist and you say you appeal to, you know, go out there to get grants and you say, I'm going to research psychokinesis. You've already cut out 99%, you know, of your potential funders
who need,
you know,
them.
They're going to. yeah, this guy's nuts. What are you talking about? Even though they may be hypocritical and already have had paranormal experiences, but they know what they have to present to their board of, you know, whatever their, you know, board that governs the fund or whatever. And they're all, you know, conservative, not in the sense of politically conservative, but just conservative in the sense that they don't want to change the paradigm. You know, they don't want to break through. And it's very difficult to do. And if you look at people like John Mack, Dr. John Mack, who died many years ago, but he researched abductions and at Harvard, he was a Harvard psychiatrist, very, you know, won a Pulitzer Prize, you know, for a book that he written. When he started doing that research, Harvard tried to get rid of him. So it's a very, it's a career killer. And actually, when I published my first book, a former student of mine, I won't mention their name, but they're now at a prominent university as a historian, as a professor. And they told me when they heard about the book, they were very concerned and said, do you realize you've just committed academic suicide? I think that's very telling. So that's part of it. It's self-preservation. But like I preface this whole thing by saying, I'm 65 years old. I don't really care what people think. I don't care. I mean, you know, my mom always said, you'll get the truth always from children and old people. Because the children don't know that they're supposed to lie yet. And the old people don't care. They don't care anymore.
My only issue is that, like, if you know the Robertson panel about the UAP stuff, all those people that were labeled nut job scientists, even though they had plenty extended long academic careers, and they were just assigned to understand what this unidentified object is. And now you got the government acknowledging UAPs, which I don't really believe because I don't believe a word that they say. But if you really look into, like, now we're all just talking about it and they're now making classes about studying unidentified aerial phenomena. I'm like, what about the number of people that have been blackballed and called tinfoil hats and basically pushed down and lost all their careers? And some of them committed suicide. Do we not talk about that? I mean, we spent so much time in the beginning saying this is nothing, don't look into it, and if you do, you're gonna risk your career. And now we're like, hey, yeah, that might be a possibility. I'm like, I'm glad we're turning the tides, but at the same time, it's like, why did we ever label it like that in the first place?
Yeah, it's you know, I'm gonna give you a story because you wanted to talk.
I wanted to get into your
paranormal. Yeah. I'll go into a good story. And this is in one of my books. I can't remember which one of my timeless books, but what happened was that I had been on the Coast to Coast show, you know.
Yes. Art Bell?
No, it was after. It was, okay. One of the Georges. I think it was George Norrie. I've interviewed by George Norrie and George Knapp, but I think this was George Norrie. And right after it, I got contacted by a film producer, right? And he wanted to do a documentary and he had an idea for it and he's looking for a psychic. He said, I think you'd be perfect. And I said, well, I'm not a professional psychic. I'm just, you know, I'm an academic I've had these experiences. And he said, well, I think you'd be perfect. I want to fly you out to Chicago and test you. And I thought, okay. And I said, well, I'm not going to go unless I thought, okay, this guy is, if he's serious. And then I said, well, I'm not going to come out there unless my wife can go with. And he said, oh, I'll fly her out too. And I said, okay, well, this guy must be serious. So he flies us out there with the intention of testing me, taking me to different sites around the Chicago area, you know, like within 50 miles of Chicago. And I'm not going to tell you what has happened there. I just want to see what you pick up. I'm going to film it. You're going to be mic'd up. You're going to be filmed. And I want to see, you know, test your abilities. So I took it as a challenge. So unfortunately, my hubris took over. This is also a part that's difficult when trying to pin down the paranormal is your hubris, you know, your own overwhelming sense of pride. You know, I'm going to show them what I can do, you know. And then the other thing is the self-doubt that you can have as well. And then the other thing is sometimes it doesn't work. You know, I mean, there's so many different variables. Anyway, I show up there, long story short, doing these different things, mildly successful, but not impressive. And he's like, it's pretty good. But, you know, I did another guy and he was great, but he can't do it anymore. And that's a whole other story. But So I was thinking, man, I really got to do something now. So he took me to this location in the south side of Chicago, and I was going to show this guy something. So I get out of the car. We park in this Aldi's parking lot, right? You know, Aldi's whatever that German owned.
We just got one down here.
Yeah, and anyway, so we parked there. It's a bad neighborhood, you know. I mean, south side of Chicago, pretty rough neighborhood, right? I get out. As soon as I get out of the car, I call this putting up my radar dish. I just put it up. I didn't even do any protection or preliminary preparation. I'm gonna show this guy, you know, my pride, right? The radar dish goes out. It's the best way I explain it, when I just take in everything, you know, in this interface, beyond everything. And what I saw was like an old black and white movie, kind of jerky, you know, like this. And it was like these horses and carriages and people in dark clothing just rushing by. And I thought, that's pretty cool. I'm seeing this like old timey Chicago, you know, like from the 1880s. That's what it seemed like to me. And I could see it with my mind's eye right in front of me, right? Because I'm totally open to everything, right? But there's one guy stationary and he's standing there looking at me and he's got a bowler hat on. He's got really dark eyes. He's got one of those snidely whiplash mustaches, you know, the curly mustache. And he's just staring at me with like a death stare. And I go, oh, that guy's pretty scary. And then all of a sudden, the image went away, right? So I said, I got to get that back. It's kind of like you lose a signal in your radio or your TV or in the old timey TVs. So I was walking around. I saw this old tree. And sometimes if you touch things that are old, you can get it back, get the connection back. This is kind of insider scoop on how I do things, by the way. So I'm touching this old tree, and as soon as I touch it, all of a sudden it's like somebody tackled me and drove me into the ground. I mean, just smacked me right down into the ground. I mean, physically, just, but there was nobody there. I mean, there was no physical person there. Smashed me down into the ground. I couldn't even get up. I was like being pressured into the ground. And when I was down on the ground, and by the way, my knee and my foot was injured, so you know, it was painful. I saw the image of people under the ground, like reaching up, you know, in agony and like in pain, and they were dying, you know, and they were just like reaching up at me, all bloody and everything. And I go, oh, that's horrible. That I got to get out of here. But I was losing my intention, my not my intention. I was losing my will to live. It's like I was being drawn into this dungeon thing, you know. And finally, and I told the guy, I was mic'd up, but I wasn't filmed because the guy was having trouble with the camera. And I said, you got to come over. There's something wrong here. And he goes, I feel it too. There's something really bad. And he comes over there, and I struggled and got back to the ground, or up, you know, up. I was injured, but we walked back towards his car. And he said, we got to get out of here. And I said, yeah, I don't want to be here. I don't know what this place is, but I'm getting out of here. And he said, I agree. And then as we were putting stuff in his car and we sit down, I said, what is this place? And he said, well, this is the location of the murder hotel.
Holy
This is
shit.
where Dr. H.H. Holmes had a hotel with dungeons and torture chambers. It's the exact location, right? The exact location. And he had murdered maybe up to 300 people there, tortured them and murdered them. Around the 1890s, around 1893, I think it was or 1890s, the time of the Chicago World's Fair. That was about the time. So it would fit with everything that I saw. But I wasn't really that familiar with H.H. Holmes, right? So I went on the internet and I looked. The first thing that popped up when I put you know, H.H. Holmes was a picture of a man in a bowler hat with dark, scary eyes and a curly Q mustache. And I go, oh my God, that is him. And so I had picked up on that. And it was
Question about when you saw him, when you were and he was in front of you staring at you, did you think he was staring at you specifically or he was just staring in that direction? Do you think you brought yourself back to a time or brought yourself over there, or do you think you were in someone else's perception or conscious?
I no, I was there. I was witnessing that time period and him, but he seemed to be independent of that time, somewhere stuck between that time and my time now, the current timeline. So he was aware of me. It wasn't like a, you know, like some of these experiences I have, ghost experiences and so forth, are like kind of like films, you know, like loops of film, right? they're not interactive. This was interactive. I could see him staring at me and with a very evil intent. And then it went away. So when I touched that tree, the evil that possessed him or him himself, I'm not quite sure, or some combination, is the physical force that drove me into the ground. It's partly my response. It's partly my fault and partly the fault of the TV producer, because I told him, I got mad at him as we were driving away. I said, don't ever put me in that situation again without giving me a little bit more warning, because I was physically injured and psychically injured. I mean, when I came back down here to Southern California where I live and went to teach my paranormal class, I had several psychics that were taking the class, professional psychics, and they couldn't stand to be near me. They said, you got a dark energy about you. What's happened? And then I told them what happened. And this one lady who was a psychic, she got physically ill. She had to go outside and throw up, and it was awful. And it was a very real experience, and it was very frightening and taught me a good lesson, which is that you should always do protection. Even if you're trying to impress somebody, even if you're in a hurry, take the time to do protection. And if somebody tells you there's a demon somewhere, go in there and get it. Say no. Just say, I believe you. And I would never do that again. I would never purposefully put myself in that situation. There are people that are demon hunters or whatever you call them, exorcists, right? That's their business. They know how to do that. I'm not an exorcist. You know, that was a horrible experience. And anyway, so that's, I thought your listeners might enjoy that, because that's something they can look up, H.H. Holmes and that location in Chicago. That's where I was.
Can I ask about your first experience when you were 5 or 6, and then maybe what you started to learn about, like, when how do you look for education on this? How do you look for research to hone your abilities? I've heard the touching an old object. There's like photographs and stuff my grandmom used to be able to do. My mom always used to say she could talk to spirits and stuff like that. And my brother doesn't have any abilities like that at all, but I have like really crazy deja vu that, like, it's kind of like a little bit of future seeing a little bit. And like I said, I don't really talk about it or glorify it a whole lot, but also I can get emotions really quickly. Like if I look at a photograph or something like that, I can get a bunch of like weird energies from it. Now my mom's more interested in that than I am. I'm more like, hey, look, I'm just gonna drink a beer or something and kind of ignore it and trying to walk past it. But my grandmom was always very interested in that. She always used to talk about talking to spirits and things of that sort. And I was, you know, she died a couple of years ago, but I never had the full chance to actually engage in conversation about it because she did not like openly talking about it. But I'm curious what you could find and what your first experience was at 5 or 6, and then what path did you go on to start learning all these little bits and pieces that slowly add up to, like, touching an old object can help amplify, and just little tips and tricks. I don't want to call it that, but just more information that helped you understand it more.
Yeah. And I'll start with this, because you shared that about your grandmother and your mom. It does run in the family. And it's like, if your mother has several children, not every one of them is going to have these natural abilities. Everybody has something, but not everybody's going to be as highly fine-tuned. It's like the analogy I like to make is everybody can throw a ball, right? But not everybody can throw a ball 90 miles an hour. You know, there's natural ability, and then there's the innate ability that, yes, I can throw a ball, or I can throw a ball fast enough to be a major league pitcher, right? So there's different skill sets, right? But my first experience that I remember was when I was 5 years old in northern Norway, 200 miles above the Arctic Circle, in a house that my dad was born in and that I still own on a farm in northern Norway. And it was the winter time, and I got very, very sick suddenly. I mean, I was like almost paralyzed. I could barely move, couldn't move my head from side to side, had a high fever, was, you know, in a really bad shape. My friends brought me home, put me in my grandmother's kitchen in this old country farmhouse. She had a little bed there where she would rest while she was baking or making food or whatever, because she had an injured leg, couldn't get up and down the steep stairs. So anyway, she had this little bed. I was resting on that bed. I was lying down crying. And my grandmother, my mother, relatives are coming by saying, I don't think he's going to make it. You know, this is what happened to his uncle when he got, or his cousin when he got polio. You know, this is what happened. So they were scaring the heck out of me, right? And I cried myself to sleep. And when I woke up, and there was this bright light, and there was nobody in the kitchen at the time. It was a bright light in the ceiling of the kitchen, and it was warm. And I remember feeling, oh, everything's going to be okay. And I started feeling like I could move, you know, and everything was going to be okay. And I went back to sleep. And when I woke up, my grandmother and my mom were there. I opened my eyes. I jumped up. I ran around like a kid would at 5 years old. And they said, it's a miracle. You're healed. And I told them about the light, the warm light, the healing light that made me feel good. And I didn't know what it was, you know, I didn't know how to express it other than that. My grandmother, my mother said, that was your guardian angel that healed you. It's a miracle. And I just accepted that. Okay. That's how it works, you know? And what that did was open up that world, that aperture that for children is already open, opened it up even wider. And then because my mom was very psychic and taught me telepathy, it stayed open. And I learned, you know, I didn't shut it down because I knew, like my mom said, when to talk about it and when not to talk about it, who to talk to about it and who not to talk to about it. And so that's how it started. I think that opened it up for me, and experiences just kept happening. They happened frequently, randomly. I didn't know how to control it. I didn't know how to manage it. It would just happen. I'd have spontaneous, like I'd go into a crowd of people and I'd always feel uncomfortable at parties because I can remember from a young age, because it's not that I could read people's minds, but I could read their intentions. And that's almost worse. Because, you know, somebody's talking, and this happens to me all the time. If I'm watching television and I see politicians speaking, it just makes me sick. I don't care what political party they are. It doesn't matter. It's like I'm reading between the lines. I know what their intention is, and I can just like see right through it. And if you can imagine going to a party and that's all you hear is the intention, not what they're saying, but what they really mean. And it's very disturbing. And I had to learn how to turn that off. And that's really important, to learn how to turn it off. That's for your listeners. The most important thing is to learn how to turn it off. And the second most important thing is, if you're going to engage it, do protection of some kind. And whatever your tradition is, it doesn't really matter what tradition it is, do protection before you intentionally try to connect, and know how to turn it off.
My friends will be the first people to tell you that they usually come to me when they have advice about someone that they're either meeting for the first time or talking to, or if there's someone that they want to get to know or something like that. And my buddy gives the best description for me, which is like, Robbie gives off the energy that you put out. He was like, if you give him like a weird vibe or a vibe that he's not going to talk, he's not going to want to engage with you. But if you open up with like nice energy and just calm stuff, he'll be there. And my buddy's not an energy guy at all. He's not into any of that. He's very, you know, just like, I like to live life, and that's how it is. There's nothing else, just living life. But hearing him say it, and I didn't notice it until, and I thought I was just empathetic as a person, that I could just kind of sense people. But it's why I isolate all the time. I can't deal with heavy topics sometimes. I can't deal with, certain days of I go to the store, it has to be first thing as soon as it opens at like 6 a.m. I work an overnight shift because nobody's awake. I don't have to deal with walking around and feeling my neighbor's issues through my wall or something like that, which sounds ridiculous, to be honest with you, but it's just how I've always been. And trying to explain it to people that have never experienced or don't know what that is like, they kind of look at you like you're nuts. So I just stopped talking about it.
No, you're that's a very natural thing. And think of, if we were in ancient times, that skill set is what people needed to survive. If you encountered another group of cavemen, you know, you want to know their intentions. You don't, you know, what they, whatever they said, right? That doesn't matter. What are their intentions? You know, and that's beyond language. You know, it's really beyond language. You know, it's what, you know, they're intending to steal your food or your women or your water rights or whatever, or your cave space, you know, which is basically how war started, right? It's, we're still fighting over the same reasons, you know. It's so sad when you really think about it. But anyway, you're in tune with your ancient self. That's what I always say. You got to be in tune with your ancient self and cultivate that. And as you get older, it'll just get stronger and stronger. And that's a good thing. That's a survival mechanism, and it's something that'll serve you well. It's already serving you well, and your friends have already noticed it, even if they're not, you know, studying these things or whatever. It doesn't matter. People sense that. And yeah, so my best advice to anybody on this kind of a path is just to be in touch with your ancient self, which means realize that, be open to it, you know, open the aperture, but be careful, because there, you know, like my experience, you know, with H.H. Holmes, you know, that there is a lot of negative stuff out there too. You know, there's a lot of fascinating, wonderful things that are not harmful out there. You know, people that desperately, like relatives or the relatives of friends of yours who desperately realize that you're a person that can hear them, because not everybody is tuned to it, you know. And I think Whitley Strieber, who wrote the book Communion, and was very, very famous UFO guy. Anyway, he said that not just talking about aliens or whatever, but that those in the spirit world can see a glow around certain people, and that's who they focus their intention on to communicate. They're not going to waste their time on some person who is totally turned off, doesn't believe it, doesn't want to have the experience, won't acknowledge anything. You know, and that's fine. That's how they want to live their life. But they're not going to waste their time and energy trying to connect with that person. They're going to go to you. They're going to go to somebody else. They're going to go to me. They're going to say, hey, listen to me. Listen, because it's really hard for them to come down to our level, and it's hard for us to get there. So we have to kind of meet them halfway. That's the way I explain it. When you put up your radar dish with protection, also knowing how to turn it off, which is important, and also having, you know, I have a couple of spirit friends that kind of are bouncers, you know, because it's important. You have allies in this effort, and do some research and talk to people who do this a lot, and then get prepared to do it and take it baby steps along the way. But anyway, it takes a lot of energy for you to get up and for them to come down a little bit so you can communicate. And even then, it's like the faintest of radio signals. If you imagine an old radio with a barely tuned in, very low volume, you're catching every other word. That's kind of the standard. Every once in a while, you'll get something really clear, loud and clear, or Lima Charlie, like we used to say in the Army, loud and clear. But most of the time, it's staticky. It's hard to understand. There's lots of room for misinterpretation, but you have to trust it. And do the best you can. And I got one bit of advice from a psychic, a very powerful psychic, said, you're as psychic as you need to be, which I think is pretty interesting when you think about it. Like, if you're not ready, if a person is not ready, you know, then wait, you know, wait until you are ready. You know, it may take a little more preparation. But it's you know, it's not like I talked to some Native Americans recently, and we were talking about, I told them that I was on what they would call a medicine path. And their initial impression was, oh, well, there's a lot of white people who think they're medicine men. I said, I don't think I'm a medicine man. Don't get me wrong. I'm just saying, I understand the world that you're describing because I've experienced it my whole life, and I didn't ask for it. And they said, that's the key. The true medicine man never asks to be a medicine man. They accept the gift. They realize that that's what they're destined to do. And like the first sentence of my timeless book was, it's not that I believe in ghosts. It's that they believe in me, so I don't have a choice. That's what it comes down to. You have that natural thing, and you can't deny it. I mean, you could spend your life denying it, but then you're not the person you're intended to be. And that's, I spent my whole life trying to, you know, not discuss it, even though it was happening all the time. If you can imagine all these experiences, not being able to talk about them, except to very few people, or when it happened to somebody else at the same time as me, which was rare, but it did happen. Other than that, I had to keep it to myself. Yeah, so that's, you know, just recently, you know, like I said, 2016 is when I fully embraced it and took the leap, not a leap of faith, but what I call a leap of consciousness. And that's where I'm at. And that's why we're here talking You know, there's a reason why you're talking to me, or I am talking to you, and that you approach me, and I you know, looked at some of your shows, and I go, this is a cool guy. I like Rob.
Could I ask if you've ever pushed it to the point like where you opened up and just put the radar out there fully, besides the H.H. Holmes incident, but something like maybe where you were in a better setting, like your house or something, where you can kind of sit back and like, I'm going to let everything in all at once and see how far I can really go with this.
Yeah. And that's what I do with, you know, now we're venturing into the realm of the NHI, you know, non-human intelligence kind of stuff. But before I veer off a little bit, let me say this. It's very clear to me, and not just me, but many others as well, that the spirit world, you know, where people go after they pass on from this existence, the alien, so-called alien world, which is really a lot, it's kind of a misnomer, and the quantum world are all the same thing. And these walls that we've created, like the UFO people won't talk to the ghost hunters. The ghost hunters don't want to talk to the UFO people. People, it's the same thing. It's the same thing. It's the quantum world, this implicate order that David Bohm, the American physicist, talked about. That's the way things really are. What we have, like I said, is the interface. And we catch glimpses of it, right? Or we can, you know, force ourselves in there. So what I did to do what you said is I take regular spirit walks, what I call spirit walks. Now, I don't know about you, but if I'm going to do some kind of meditation, I can't sit down and do it like some Indian fakir or whatever they call them, you know, where they sit there cross-legged in the lotus position and, you know, or whatever. I can't do that. I gotta move. So I get out there, I walk around, I do the protection, I put my radar dish up and I record. That's the other thing. It's very important. I record on my little phone everything I see, everything I hear, and what I say. Because when I didn't do that, when I started these spirit walks about 2017, 2018, on a regular basis, at first I didn't record it. So then I'd come back and I'd go, that was cool, but I can't remember anything. Because I was not in a trance, but, you know, in a very relaxed meditative state. So I started recording, and then, oh my gosh, it was pretty incredible. And I started, when I come back, I'd listen to it, transcribe it. And now I have, Rob, I have about 338 pages of single spaced notes from these transcripts I've done since 2018. And I've used that as a basis for, two of my books now, the one that came out a couple years ago and one that's coming out here next month. And so that's where I take it to the max. I also enhance it. This is the other thing. Find a place that's conducive to this. You know, maybe it's your house. Maybe it's your backyard. Maybe it's the forest, the mountaintop.
Nature for me.
Nature is very good. I have to be outside is better, although I can connect inside now that I've done it enough. I can, you know, it's kind of like the skids are greased already, right? You know, it's easier than it was at first. I was stumbling and bumbling, but now I go to a spot near here, and it's a old, what I call an old medicine road. It's a road that goes up into the mountains here. So I'm looking at the San Gabriel Mountains the whole time. There's an old wash there, and I walk up there. It's like 3/4 of a mile straight, you know, like steep. And I walk up there, and even though there's traffic, and sometimes I tune all that out. Because this is the separation between our interface and the quantum world is very thin there for some reason. Now, what evidence do I have of that? Well, one thing is that I saw images of ancient people, indigenous Indian people walking in when it was a path, you know, an animal path or, during their day, before it was a road, before any modern stuff. And also at the base of this road, at the very bottom of the road, is, and I'm not kidding you, is a Freemason temple.
Oh, God.
And I thought, I don't know, I'm not a big expert on the Freemasons, but I do know this. They don't put their temples just anywhere. Because they do ritual magic. You know, they want to put it in the best place to position them to do their magic, do their stuff, you know? And so... So that's where it starts. And then I walk 3/4 of a mile up towards the mountains. And by the time I get to the top, I've finished my communication and I've recorded everything. And then I, you know, put the radar dish away. So that's how I get maximum signal boost, if you will. It's called, a lot of people call it the signal line, you know, that you pick up, whether it's visual, audio, imagery, feelings. You know, sometimes it's an emotion. Sometimes it's a smell. It could be a lot of different, or it could be all of those things at once. I've even seen handwriting, like I'll ask a question and then I'll see, like, in cursive, in golden lettering usually, which is kind of interesting. Like I'll say, is this really true? And then I'll see, like, yes. And then it'll kind of fade away. Sometimes I'll hear a voice. Sometimes I'll see imagery, like instead of words or spoken thing, I just see an image or even a tape loop. Like, you know, and this is how I do it. And I've made a connection to one particular entity that I call Anzar. Actually, I don't call him that. He calls himself that. And he's been with me since I was a kid, intervening in my life. And he first described himself as the, now I'm going to get way out there on a limb. So some people might say, oh yeah, come on. The first time he identified himself, he said, I am the progenitor. Now, the progenitor is the person who originated everything, started everything, right? The progenitor, the first person, or the person who starts something, right? And then later, when I started these spirit walks and communicated with him directly more instead of just randomly, he said, well, my name is Anzar, the progenitor. Now, I hadn't studied ancient North African history or anything. My history is U.S. history, right? But apparently Anzar is the water god in Morocco, the Berber people, more correctly called the Amazigh people. That is their water god, which is kind of interesting when you think about it. And I've had a couple of researchers contact me and say, How did you come up with the name Anzar? Were you familiar with Berber culture? And I said, I don't know anything about Berber culture, you know, even though I'm a historian, I didn't know. So that's what he told me his name was. And anyway, that's who I mostly talk to. I do talk to my mom and dad, people that have passed on, my friend Jean and some others. And occasionally I'll have a friend or a colleague say, hey, my Uncle Harry passed away. Would you mind trying to reach him and tell him that I love him? Or, you know, there's always some kind of work they want me to do. And they say, can I pay you? And I said, I don't want any money. This is a privilege, you know, and I'm not going to guarantee anything. Sometimes I can reach people. Sometimes I can't. Sometimes it makes sense to the person. Sometimes it doesn't. But oftentimes it's right on. And the people are very appreciative. And that's really what this connection is all about. That's what I'm supposed to be doing, is helping people. It's not about being right or wrong. It's about, are you helpful? And that's what my books are about. That's what why I talk to you and other people. I want to be helpful and help people realize that they have this potential that maybe they've been told that they don't have.
Can I ask if you ever looked into the government's acknowledgement of some of this? I had gotten this confused at a point, but I'm big into the Kennedy assassination, and I had been looking for a document that has been well recommended and well kind of talked about as like the main, like, smoking gun, I would say. It's called 1095-360. It's the first document where the term conspiracy, now conspiracy has been used in other documents before, but it was the first time it was ever given to news media outlets that anybody that doubted the official conclusion, you call them a conspiracy theorist. That's everybody's smoking gun of, like, that's the government's corruption. Well, I had typed it in accidentally, like, the wrong way. So instead of saying 1095-360, I typed in 1035-960. Now, if you type that in, you will get a 12-page paper by the CIA all about the human consciousness, about the gateway experience, about other things like holograms and all of this. And I have showed it on air. Everyone can go look it up. I'll even link it in the description of this video so people can be able to click it and check it out. But they looked at it. They actually went through it. They had diagrams of the brain. They had a full summary report on what the gateway experience was, talking about different types of perceptions and what this understanding of belief is. And you're like, this is our CIA. You know, the same people that'll tell you, you know, like, oh, buzz off, you hippie. These people are looking at it like, hey, let me just check this out real quick, which makes me wonder what else have they experienced. And of course, if you've seen the movie Men Who Stare at Goats, I know people laugh because it's a movie with George Clooney. Well, it's based on a True thing. Like that's my mom went was an hour away from where they kept the goats at that college or whatever, or high school or whatever. So that's a real thing our government has kind of looked into about psychological warriors and things of this sort. So I feel like if with that track record, historians and most historians should not be like, oh, that's conspiracy, that's make believe. Well, our government looked into it, so then you really don't trust who your government is.
Right. Yeah, I've talked to Lynn Buchanan, who was one of the psychic spies. I've talked to him a number of times, and he lives near, where does he live? Alamogordo, I think, near Alamogordo. And anyway, we had quite a discussion about it, and I've read his books, and I've listened to all kinds of interviews with Joe McMonagle, who was like psychic spy number one, And yeah, it's very real. I've done remote viewing. That's basically just another way to utilize the paranormal for good, and I've tried to do it. Like there was a girl that was.
Obama used it in 2014 to get Osama bin Laden. He said it was one of the factors that helped him. A lot of people don't believe that, but he actually admitted to that.
They do use it, and that's what Lynn Buchanan said. He ultimately decided he didn't want to do it for the government anymore because there was one really bad incident he had where some children were killed, and he said, "That's it. I don't want to do it." So he dedicates himself to teaching other people and to finding missing children. That's what he does now exclusively. But I know for a fact that the top remote viewer working for the government today secretly, and I can't say his name because I was told if I say his name, although I've seen video of him doing stuff, secret video, if I say his name, they'll probably not allow this video to be shown. It'll be taken off the air, or bad things will happen that are, things that are not good. So, but I do know that we still have an active program, obviously. If you have these people who can do this, why wouldn't you use it? Even if you think it's hogwash, let's at least try it. I mean, that's, you want to bring everything to bear. But there, yeah, I do know who the top one is. But and people always go, man, I wish I had that ability. But think about it. I know that this guy who's the top guy, he's not allowed to travel outside of the country. He's constantly monitored. He has no freedom. He is so valuable to our government that he has no freedom. And it reminds me of this old 60s television show called The Prisoner. I'm not sure if you're familiar with it. It's a British TV show. You should check it out, where this guy resigns from MI5 or whatever, some super secret spy agency, right? And they send him to live in this nightmarish world where he's not sure what's real and what isn't real, and he's just referred to as a number. And the big tagline from that show is, "I'm not a number, I'm a free man." Well, the concept here is that if you have that much ability, you're not going to be free. And people, you could even make the argument we're not really free anyway because we're being monitored so much. Anyway, we could get into a whole discussion about that, but yes, this is very real. I've experienced it myself. The Kennedy assassination, I am obsessed with it, have been for many, many years. I get all my students excited about it, and I always warn them. I say, okay, I'm warning you, if you start to get into this, it's probably going to be a lifelong obsession.
It is
And
for 2 years in so far, and it's got me.
yeah, and I've met people that were part of it, like the daughter of one of the Cubans who was involved, who wouldn't. I tried to get her father to come in and talk to my class. This was like 28 years ago when I started teaching the Vietnam class up in Washington State. And she asked her father, this Cuban man who had been part of the Cubans who were the anti-Castro Cubans, and he said, "I know there's no way I'm going to come in and talk to anybody in public about this." And I had a student whose father flew with David Ferry, one of the conspirators, for Eastern Airlines, and he also would not talk. you know, now these people are all dead. You know, they're likely all dead.
Yeah, we
now,
just lost a good buddy of mine, the only person to testify before the church committee, and we have his transcripts that were released to the JFK files, but they actually never fully published it in the church committee. But he interviewed Agent Elmer Moore, and Elmer Moore had been one of the Secret Service people that were basically gave another full-on conclusion that, lone nut, this is what happened. Well, he voiced a lot of different opinions to Jim. Jim, sadly, the interesting thing was 3 days ago, I had messaged him because I just got this urge to be like, maybe I should talk to him again, and just passed away today. So,
yeah. Oh, that's sad. I'm
crazy.
I'm sorry to hear that. I was in Dealey Plaza in August of, or July, late July of last year, because I had never been to Dealey Plaza and I always wanted to go. I went at a very strange time. It was very early in the morning, but it was still hot. It was in Dallas and it was really hot. Even early in the morning, but there were very few people there. And I walked around. I went behind where the white picket fence was at the, obviously they've rebuilt. I stood where Abraham Zapruder stood on that pedestal, or next to the pedestal, because the pedestal has kind of a little bit of a point on it. So it's harder, you know, I'm 65, so I can't like spring up onto a pedestal. But anyway, so, and then I walked the grounds. I stood where James Tague was by the triple underpass, and you know, where the bullet fragment hit the concrete and chipped up onto his cheek or whatever. I stood right where the headshot was, and I just walked it. And I did a spirit walk there, and I recorded it. And what I was told from my friends in the quantum world was that it was a CIA operation, that there were people that were unaware of each other, different groups there, taking, you know, there to kill the president, but nobody knows for sure who might have done it, except the person behind the white picket fence, who Lee Bowers in the railroad yard
yep.
observation tower, which is still there, by the way, that observation tower is still there. Lee Bowers saw two men behind the fence. One of them was in a police uniform with a rifle, and Lee Bowers died mysteriously as well.
One of the many, and surprisingly the one that would be the most, I guess, proof that there is something strange going on. I made a clip about Jim Cothey. He was the one that investigated Jack Ruby's apartment the day Jack Ruby shot Oswald. He died. He's the only one to die in this crazy way, but it's a throat chop. Official cause of death, that's on the autopsy report. Blunt force trauma to the throat. And the guy put in there karate chop. So it had to be one guy that was able to get into his apartment and hit him while he was stepping out of the shower, and enough with one strike to kill him in an instant like that. But yeah, there's footage you can watch online of his body being dragged out and the guy giving the official cause of death and everything. It's crazy stuff, but they called it a harmful conspiracy and they took it off YouTube. I was like, for what? I have the autopsy. Like,
sure. Yeah. And then Charles Crenshaw, you've probably seen that video of the trauma room one. He wrote a book about it too before he died. There's video online. You can look up Charles Crenshaw, and he tells the story of, you know, treating Kennedy, and you know that the wound in his neck was a frontal wound. It was an entry wound. Later, it was carved out to make it look like an exit wound. And then he said the headshot was not from the rear, but from the front. And he was a surgeon, you know, I mean, who had treated gunshot wounds. He knew what ballistic damage is, you know, goes in little, comes out big, you know, that pretty classic stuff. And anyway, Charles Crenshaw. And then I know Beverly Oliver, who's still alive. She was an eyewitness there on the median, you know, the grassy median on the other side of the street from the grassy knoll. She witnessed it and said the shots came. The kill shot came from behind the white picket fence. There were other shots that came from over towards the Daltex building and the Texas School Book Depository. But she also knew Jack Ruby. She was friends with Jack Ruby, and she I don't know if you've heard about her. She's been, people have tried to discredit her for years, but anyway, she was a dancer at a different club and used to go to the Carousel Club that Jack Ruby owned. In order to, you know, Jack Ruby was always trying to get her to dance at his club instead, you know, switch clubs or whatever. And one time she came there, this is before the assassination, and Jack Ruby was sitting at a table with a young man, kind of a serious looking man, And she was introduced to him, and Jack Ruby introduced her. Beverly, I'd like you to meet Lee from the CIA. And she didn't think much about it because a lot of people make up stories in the criminal underworld, you know, and he was, of course, Ruby's part of the mafia or mobbed up. And she said he was rude and she just didn't pay much attention to him. But after the assassination and they printed this, the picture of Lee Harvey Oswald, she goes, "Oh my God, that is Jack's friend. That's Lee from the CIA, the one that he introduced me to." So she, you know, just, you know, she had met, not only was she friends with Jack Ruby, she had met Lee Harvey Oswald. So, but there's so many, there's just so much, right? Yeah. I mean, we could go into it forever, but I did that spirit walk and it was all confirmed, you know, all of what I had suspected, you know. it's what I call a chaotic conspiracy, in that, and the basic tenets, and I've come up with this after all these years of researching it, is of my chaotic conspiracy theory is that if enough people want you dead, you'll end up dead. And there are a lot of people who wanted Kennedy dead, both Kennedys, actually, yeah. And they got both of them, right? And the second one is that people can be working towards the same goal and not be aware of each other. That's why I said there were different groups that were there. And then people say, well, that's pretty coincidental. How could that happen? Well, think about it. How often are you going to get the president out in the open, surrounded by buildings, which is basically the worst possible scenario for physical security? You've worked in security, so you know that. How are you going to defend against that? You know, and then they took the bubble top off. You know, just ridiculous set of circumstances. But
well, plus there's Gerald Ford moving the back wound up 6 inches, and in his official report, he said to make the single bullet theory more convincing. And then you have the missing brain that's been missing since 1966 that just disappeared from the National Archives. And then you got bullets and brain matter that were picked out of a limousine at Parkland Hospital and cleaned up with a soap and bucket. And none of that was submitted into evidence. So there's a lot I always just tell people. I'm like, if you think that's normal in any part of like an investigation or any proper procedure, then we'll just base the facts of the Secret Service shouldn't have been out drinking the night before. They were out till 5 a.m. drinking. So, I mean, moonshine and things of that sort. That's why they're all wearing sunglasses.
It's probably not unusual for Secret Service.
Yeah, that's literally in their report was like it was an average day for the Secret Service to do. But going back to the paranormal stuff, I want to ask just sort of like a final wrapping point because you've given me enough of your time. But what would you recommend to anybody that has experienced something or has these types of things that they've never really looked into, either whether it's abilities or whether it's just feelings that they get? And, you know, how can we talk about it or get them a message to the point where they can either decide to look into it, maybe a certain area, or just be able to normalize the conversation, not maybe completely shut it out like society will tell them to do eventually?
Well, I'll lead with this, what my friend Gene said when he told me it's all true. And just start with that. You know, that's pretty mind-blowing when you think about it. And then you can go back and say, okay, well, I had this thing happen to me, but I don't think it's real. And then you hear in the back of your mind, but it's all true. If it happened to you, your senses, okay, write it down, have it documented somewhere, write it down. People that might have witnessed it, get their statements, you know, document all this stuff. And then slowly you'll build up this idea. You'll pass through what Jim Mars, the late Jim Mars, the JFK researcher.
Crossfire.
Yeah, what he called the boggle factor, because all of us have it. Even I have it with all my experiences. Somebody will tell me something, I'll go, oh, that can't be true. Is it true? Wait a second, let me think about it. You know, that's that immediate response, that skepticism. It's kind of natural. You push beyond that boggle factor. And then Gene told me this. He said, experiencing is believing, and believing is experiencing. So once you know that something is true, it opens up another experience. It's like different layers. You'll just keep going deeper and deeper and deeper, and document it all, trust yourself, trust your connection. Be careful, you know, because there are bad entities out there. Protect yourself, learn how to turn it off in social situations so you don't end up a wallflower like me, you know. Have to avoid all social. I mean, I can do it. I can go to a party for a limited amount of time, but you know, I have to focus on one person and tune out all the other stuff I'm trying to, you know. And so there are survival mechanisms you can use, but, you know, you got to trust yourself, trust your ancient self. That's the bottom line, I would say, and cultivate it. If you trust certain people, you know, certain people who are intuitives, who are psychics and not like charlatan kind of psychics, you know, the one, if they charge money, run away, you know, for the most part, unless you really know them, you know, because I don't mind if people make a living or whatever, but you got to be honest, you know. And there's a tendency for some people who charge to make up stuff or do cold readings. You know, it's like they know how to manipulate people, like a circus show kind of mind reader. You know, they can pick up on tells and stuff like that. Have you tell them stuff unknowingly and then you regurgitate it back to them and they think, oh, how did they know that? Well, because you just told them, more or less, you know. So you got to be careful of those people. But there are real people who can do this, and they'll do it for free to help you, and trust them, and learn, and keep reading, and do some you know, some meditation, either in your own home or a safe place, or if you want to do walking meditation, you can try that, and just open yourself up to it. And yeah, I had a friend of mine recently, actually an editor, one of my books. He said, I really want to have experiences, and he basically asked the same thing. And I gave him the same advice, you know, be your natural self, you know, don't hide it from yourself. You know, if these things happen to you, believe that it happened to you. That doesn't mean you have to believe everything, you know, naively, but, you know, believe it happened to you and trust yourself. And that's the simplest way I could put it. And it's quite a journey. Once you open that up, a lot of things will start to connect, you know, that maybe didn't connect before, and it'll start making more sense.
Well, Bruce, where can people find some of your links, man, to your books, to your website?
Yeah, all my books are on Amazon. So just my name, just look me up on Amazon, and you'll find my previous books, all my academic books too. There's like 8 of those that I did. And then I took this turn towards the paranormal and stuff. And the supernatural and, you know, UFO stuff. So that's where they can find me. I also have a website, just my whole name, BruceOlavSolheim.com, and my full name. And so I try to keep that updated. I'm on Facebook too, Bruce Solheim. It's only 2 of us on Facebook, one guy that lives in Minnesota and me. So I'm not the one who runs marathons. That's the other guy, the other Bruce.
There's about 2 Robbie Robertsons, but I beat out the guitar player. So
there you go. Yeah. So yeah, that's it. And I, you know, I really appreciate you talking to me, and I'd love to come back. I think we have a good connection. And I don't mean just like a technical connection, but I think a spiritual connection, and that's more important. And yeah, so this new book, it's called We Are the Aliens: A Case of Alien-Human Integration, which I put everything together. It's like, you know, which is also what Gene told me. He said, we are the alien. I asked him, who are these aliens anyway? And he said, Bruce, we are the aliens, which really blew my mind. And that's what this book does, is that exploration of identity, who we are and who in particular I am. And it's kind of a fun book. It's been a fun book. I'm in the final editing of it now. And it'll be out probably end of this month, early April.
I'll have you back on for sure to talk about that one. But let me see if I can get you on one of my buddy's shows. You might find a large interest in speaking with. He studies more of this kind of occult, esoteric type stuff, and really dives into the ancient world on things. He comes on my show to educate me a little bit about it, because it's an area I'd like to touch. But honestly, the 70s right now with the Kennedy stuff has just been, it's got a hold of me. But I'll make sure I link all your links in the description. Bruce, it's been a pleasure chatting with you. And thanks everybody for listening to this episode of Out of the Blank. Stay tuned for next episode.